Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
So this keynote is called Hashtag Feminism, Radical or Banal. I'm Claire Fox and I'm the director of the Institute of Ideas. And we wanted to organise this discussion because in a very weird way, but probably illustrated by this attendance, feminism has rarely been as popular or potentially energetic as it is today. And there are a whole range. The hashtag bit is because there's a whole range of online campaigns, such as Bring Back Our Girls, that speak to saying feminism is the new thing. Suzanne Moore actually said, the energy of a new generation of feminism, however, dissipates because it is not anchored by any political structure. So even though feminism appears to be everywhere, there are then queries, possibly generational queries, as to whether actually it has any substance. But, you know, it is a weird thing that Emma Watson goes to the UN, launches the He for She campaign and talks about feminism at the UN, and that is the headline. Or that Chanel's Ready to Wear show in Paris had feminism as its theme this year and featured models wearing baggy trouser suits and oversized Gloria Steinem-like specs. I'd just like to point out, it was the only time in my life that I looked like I'd ever appeared in a Chanel fashion show, because it did look like me most of the time. Everything's oversized, and I've got lots of specs. But they had kind of slogans like boys should get pregnant too, feminist but feminine, and so on. It's very odd, though, if you think about what's happened in the West, because arguably things like being chained to the kitchen sink and domestic drudgery, illegal abortions, disapproval of women who have sex before marriage, blatant misogyny in the workplace, explicit sexism, downright inequality don't appear to be part of women's lives at the same time as this explosion of interest on feminism. But as something like the Everyday Sexism Project indicates, they would say, well, all right, some of the big issues might have been solved or seem to be solved, but in the everyday lived lives of women, catcalls, unwarranted compliments, very arguably minor instances of sexism are really adding up to something quite severe. And some of us think that's rather banal, but there are people who think, no, actually, this is an ongoing topic. If you think of some of the campaigns like No to Page 3, Lose the Lad Mags, all of the campaigns against sexist trolls and misogynist trolls, there does appear to be some real concern that women are continually treated as second-class citizens. But for those of us who were associated with something called the Women's Liberation Movement, campaigns to close down anyone who says the wrong thing sits a little uneasily. These are the kind of issues that we're going to discuss, and one of the things that it does is begs the question, what is feminism? So I actually want to quote from Kate, who just helpfully says in an article, what is feminism? A belief that gender shouldn't limit people's life chances, and yet it does, constantly, far more than merely through the laws of nature. She goes on to say a lot more, but I did think that there is a question there that needs to be answered. That has not been solved necessarily. The format is that the speakers are going to speak for 6 or 7 minutes each. If you've been to these events before, you'll know that that discussion, those opinions, are not presented to you as expert opinions, and that's not to insult the panel, but to kickstart us, all of us, having a conversation. So I'm going to introduce the speakers in the order in which they'll speak. Kate, who I've already referred to, is Kate Maltby, who writes regularly for The Telegraph on ethics, domestic and international politics and culture. She reviews theatre for The Spectator. She's an associate fellow of the liberal conservative think tank Bright Blue. She's also an academic, a trained classicist at Oxford and Yale, and is completing her PhD at UCL on the intellectual life of Elizabeth I and early modern translators. I've always found Kate a really interesting thinker, and so I'm absolutely delighted that she's agreed to speak here. Can we give her a warm welcome, please? Next up will be Anne Faraday, who is the CEO of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, BPAS, and before that was Director of Policy and Press for the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. She's on the board of the US research charity IBIS Reproductive Health. And I think the most important thing is that she's one of the most important voices in defence of women's autonomy and reproductive choice, not just in this country, but internationally. And she always speaks her mind, and she's always open-minded. So we're delighted to have her here. Can we give Anne a nod? So, finally, we've got Kate Feagis, who is the author of 6 books of non-fiction, most recently Our Cheating Hearts, Love and Loyalty, Lust and Lies, which has to be a great title and not to make you want to buy it. She's also written novels and is an established journalist on all the broadsheets and books editor of U Magazine, the Mail on Sundays magazine. And she's also a practising family mediator. And as it happens, when her name got mentioned as a possible speaker, I was overexcited because I've been long time a fan from afar. Aww. So I'm delighted she's here. So can we give Kate Feagis a welcome? So, Kate, kick us off and then we'll start the conversation.
Well, thank you, Claire. As Claire says, this is really a conversation between all of us, so I'm probably not even going to speak for 6 full minutes. What I am going to do, since we're starting off with Twitter and feminism, is just ask how many people here are on Twitter. Hands up. Okay, put your hands down. No, keep them up. Put your hands down if you've got fewer than 2,500 followers. I can see about 5. Okay, you guys matter. In the spirit of Twitter, you guys might be allowed to interrupt me. The rest of you can sit quietly like Twitter and ask questions at the end. Because that really is the issue here, isn't it? The question of, we're in an age of supposed, you know, huge intellectual democracy, are we operating as a group, as an elite, as a series of powerful individuals? And what does that mean for feminism? What does it mean that there are prominent voices? What does it mean that supposedly we can unite on the internet, or can we? The article that Claire quoted, that I wrote, which is very sweet of her to quote, was actually a response to Suzanne Moore, advocating in Britain the establishment of a feminist party. Now, I think Suzanne didn't mean it entirely seriously, and it is an interesting idea, but it sums up to me one of the great problems of online feminism, which is this sense that feminism, to be effective, has to work as a unified body. That if we're going to make feminist change, we all have to sign up to the same sort of political party, the same intellectual establishment. And to me, as something of an individualist, and that's why I love the Institute of Ideas. We can be as rude to each other as we like, as long as we have our own mind about it. The freedom of feminism is the opportunity to be myself, unrestrained by gender, unrestrained by class, unrestrained as much as any of us are by background. That is why, to me, it is fundamentally a liberal project. What scares me, and I know that this is not a new criticism of Twitter feminism, is the sense that if we are to make change on the internet, we all have to sign up to the same hashtag and we all have to agree with Caitlin Moran. That said, and these are just really ideas for you all to talk about, I have to admit I'm a bit of a convert, because I'm also, I mean, I'm a conservative feminist, which basically means a constant depressive. It really, what being a conservative feminist means is that I sit around being miserable a lot of the time. Because I'd like some radical change, but I'm sceptical that radical change ever works very effectively. So I sit there and I long for, you know, what do we want? Radical gender change. When do we want it? In the fullness of time. So, for example, I remember very early on noticing this woman who seemed to have a lot of followers and seemed to talk a lot on Twitter called Caroline Criado-Perez, and many of you will now know who she is. And she seemed to have this idea that we could get a woman on a banknote again. And I thought, well, you know, that does matter. It's not trivial because having female role models, having prominent women in public life, present wherever we look, that matters. But come on, Caroline, there is no way on earth that a Twitter campaign is going to change the mind of the Bank of England. And here we are. It's rather scary to admit. It's in some ways terrifying to admit. But online organisation seems to actually work. We haven't, you know, we haven't got an ex-female prime minister. We still have atrocious statistics on rape and convictions for rape, which I think we may talk about later and which just came out again this week. There is a lot of work to do, but it does seem that the only way that change has ever happened for any group is when people get together and organise, and the internet is allowing us to do that. So as I leave it to you, really, to start the conversation, what I want you to think about is that tension between the individual and the group. How much are we all beginning to toe the line as feminists? And does that matter? Can the feminist project exist if we forget the most important principle of all, which is individual freedom?
Thank you very much. That's a great start and already raised lots of things I want to talk about, so good. Anne?
Okay, as probably one of the least qualified people to talk in this debate, as probably one of the 10 people in the room who didn't put up their hands when Kate asked if they had a Twitter account, I have to say that the reason why I don't have a Twitter account is because I'm not allowed to have one from work, because the press office get really worried that I might go off on one and say something that I really shouldn't say and get us into trouble. So I'm going to come out now, and I am, in fact, the owner of... I am Mochka. Mochka at Cats for Choice. And we have a hashtag for Cats for Reproductive Choice. So that's my hashtag involvement in this. I want to talk a bit about... There's a guy here shaking his head at me. This is just bad. I want to say a bit really about feminism and a bit about campaigning and a bit about sort of issues that I think are important, because I can say I've actually never really identified as a feminist, and I find it very confusing to know exactly what it is to be a feminist, particularly in today's society, where I look at a whole load of the things that seem to be identified as being feminist, and it seems to be so wide that it's kind of everything and nothing. And in lots of ways, it seems to me that when people talk about feminism, it's not terribly distinct from how I feel as a girl or how I feel as a woman, and because these things matter to me as a girl and a woman, because I feel them in a particular way, that makes them a particularly feminist concern. And that's a different tradition to the one that I became kind of involved in. And I became, I suppose, involved in looking at political concerns when feminism wasn't seen as being the only progressive game in town. Feminism in the 1970s was actually a complete polarisation to another ism, which was Marxism. And what you had was a bunch of people who were active, who saw the inequalities and the problems that we faced in society were caused by the structure of society itself and the way that capitalist society needed to have different spheres and the way work needed to be organised and the family needed to be organised and gender divisions of labour needed to be organised. And then feminism was a kind of anti-Marxism in its first iteration. It was saying the problems of society are not caused by capitalism. Even if you got rid of capitalism, you'd still have the kind of problems that we have now, because the problem of society is really men and patriarchy. And so the feminism that I was very first introduced to was something that was very specific. And Claire mentioned the term women's liberation, and that was very important to me. And as I was involved in radical red politics and so on, it was the principles of women's liberation that really set me on fire, because the demands of women's liberation seemed to me to be the key things that women needed to achieve equality. We're talking then about four key things that the women's liberation movement constituted itself around: equal pay and job opportunities, equal opportunities in education, free contraception and abortion on demand, and free childcare. And they were four things that you could campaign for that would completely change the nature of women's lives. But you could equally campaign for them whether you were a bloke or whether you were a woman. And it actually didn't matter about how you felt about it, whether you wanted to put your child in childcare or whether you wanted to have an abortion or even whether you supported it, as long as you supported the right of other people to do that. So that, to me, has always really been, you know, insofar as, you know, I see myself as a feminist, and as I say, I don't really call myself that, it's been much more about support of women's liberation. And I think it's wrong to say that those problems have been resolved. I think that women do hit an absolute barrier when they are in a position in their fertile years, when they start thinking about having children, when they start having to take on the responsibilities, traditional responsibilities of family life and so on. And really, when you grow up and go out of being a young woman into a woman who is trying to balance a whole load of stuff in the world. So what I kind of wish about the hashtag feminism is that in some ways, when we think about it, maybe we don't think about it so much as being, you know, a kind of a form of technology or a thing that you do. It's got more to do with what you hashtag about. And I think we've at work run some really great hashtag campaigns, really good hashtag campaigns, but they've been hashtag campaigns which have been, you know, about choice and autonomy, and they've been awesome at involving people across the ages, older women and younger women as well. But I think that's the world of difference from the kind of identity feminism that basically says, you know, thin privilege is as much of an issue for you as whether or not you can attain equal pay. So that's my view.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Anne. I think it's good to have some sense of historic perspective on this as well, because there has to be some sense in which it's not entirely clear what being a feminist is. And there are times when people say things now, where people say either you're betraying feminism, or you're an anti-feminist, and you think, well, yeah, why is that? It's based on a very narrow definition. So I think we do have to discuss that. Anyway, Kate.
Yeah, well, I want to widen things out, and I wrote something yesterday, so I'm just going to read it out so that I get all my ducks in the row, because I think that actually perhaps this is provocative to suggest that feminism's most important and useful function is that it offers women of all ages a supportive way of understanding the world and our place within it as women, so that we don't feel that it's all our fault when things go wrong, or when we don't understand why it is that we're being badly treated, why we're facing humiliation, why we might be being sacked. or not being paid the same amount as a man. I think that feminism is like a constant friend that explains these numerous ways. So if you're verbally or physically assaulted as a teenager on the way home from school, it isn't your fault because of what you're wearing. If you're made redundant when you just happen to be pregnant, it isn't likely that this is just a coincidence. And if you're left impoverished as a single mother with young children because their father refuses to help or support them financially, it isn't your fault that you can't get back into the workplace to support your family and find affordable childcare. Feminism is the theory. Feminism is the political structure, and the history of feminism offers us the answer to that so that we don't think that it is our fault, which is, of course, as we know, what women have a tendency to do, to take it upon themselves. The great gift of feminism, I think, is that we can reach for it to explain that lack of a level playing field. I first felt empowered by it in 1970 at the age of 13, which, as we know, is a fragile age, when my mother, Eva Figes, published a best-selling polemic called Patriarchal Attitudes. The message that other girls at school found hard to stomach then was that women could pursue careers and mother, whereas for me that was obvious. Then in the 1980s, when I began to work for Pandora, which was a feminist publishing house, I discovered writing by women that had long lapsed out of print, as well as new polemical arguments around feminism. I then dipped out of feminism. I think that we do that personally. We dip in and out of it when we need it, which is the thing that I would like to suggest as an argument for today. Because then when I had my first child in 1989 and felt the profound alienation and loss of identity of postnatal depression, feminism came to my rescue once again and inspired my book Life After Birth on the seismic changes women experience when they have become mothers. Feminism has influenced every single one of my books in all sorts of subtle ways, but there is one that stands out as being relevant, I think, to this debate, and that's called The Big Fat Bitch Book. I went into schools to research the explosion of bitching and bitch bullying which goes on beneath the radar of teachers, and came to the conclusion, and it was deeply depressing, I share Kate's view on this, that there was one thing alone that could alleviate this, and that was feminism. Girls and boys grow up absorbing the message that they are equal and that both can and should support themselves and achieve. Yet they have little understanding of the reasons for the unequal playing field which lies ahead of them. They don't get the basics of feminist theory at school, along with a whole host of other essentials such as emotional and relationship intelligence. They don't get it from parents or the adults around them, and they certainly don't get it from the media. So when they encounter sexism, inevitably, as they will at some point, teenage girls absorb the message that it is some failing in themselves and not in wider society which is to blame. And then what they do is hit out at each other to deflect the attention from their own shortcomings, to make themselves seem bigger, stronger, and more important, as well as finding a place for all that bottled up rage to go. For, of course, as we know, good girls, they don't get angry. Boys do. If, as adult women, we find it enraging, humiliating, and upsetting to discover injustices simply because of our sex, imagine how much harder that must be for teenage girls who struggle even more than we do with their emerging sense of self. Teenagers have yet to reach more adult mindsets with greater perspective, and they're more emotionally volatile at this critical juncture in their lives. They need support with an understanding of what might lurk beneath the conflicts in their lives. When the presumption is that we have gender equality, when they can sense that they are not equal. When pornographic images containing ritualistic humiliation of girls circulate around schools on boys' phones and they are told that this is sex. Where good girls still don't and are labelled slags if they do, when girls are just as interested and just as entitled to sexual exploration as boys. I found that girls have little in the way of understanding as to why they do horrible things to each other, why they pick on one particular girl within the gang and ostracise her in a prolonged way, why they start rumours, leave abusive messages on social media, rank people so that somebody has to come bottom, or disguise something nasty as a joke. And when you come to think about it, these bitching practices are habitually employed by adults too, when they feel insecure, impotent, or ostracised from the wider social connections which are so important to us. It's just that women usually feel this more often through life than men. I would suggest that hashtag feminism is neither radical nor banal. It is what it is. A medium which reflects the times we live in and is being used by women, and particularly by young women, because it is the one thing they understand, one which they feel has an impact, and one which links them quickly to other young women when they encounter sexism firsthand for themselves. And it's the personal aspect of this that I think is really important. Because, you know, wherever that is, whether that's at university with a uni-lad culture, as my youngest daughter has just discovered after coming from a home where, you know, feminism was taken as red, she discovered sexism firsthand in a really upsetting way, or whether that's to change the most obvious inequities, such as putting the first woman on a banknote, or whether that's to link arms to others around the world over outrages such as female genital mutilation. Hashtag is just one more useful tool, but we need many more.
Thank you very much. So I want to start with you, and then I'll come straight to you. But I want to start with you just straight away, because you just raised something. Because I have found one of the more disturbing things, or two things have happened this week that I found disturbing. One was the call for the banning of the LSE rugby club. So the problem with the LSE rugby club was that it issued a sexist, misogynist leaflet. So this is the LSE rugby club. This is not a great revelation in life that the rugby club should put out a provocative leaflet, you know, and call people women abusive names. I mean, they've been doing it for a long time. But it was the call for the ban. Mm. And the second one was the Judy Finnegan question. Judy Finnegan, national treasure, on Loose Women, make some comments about rape. As it happens, I tended to agree with what she said, but that's neither here nor there. She was making a perfectly valid observation, and the world fell in on her. From a kind of brand of feminism that goes to close things down. And if I worry about something at the moment, it's the censorious nature of feminism, and also, and it's a liberalism, and also a kind of victim feminism that thinks that women need to be protected from the LSE rugby club. So I just wondered how you felt, Kate, about that. Because
I agree with you. Censorship is not the answer of any. But if you think about it, we're living within a wider culture where there is, I mean, we're in a building where they banned Exhibit B as a result of pressure because it was presumed to be racist. I find that extraordinary that this great art institution should think it's appropriate to take the exhibit off. But the adverse side of that is that by highlighting the voices of this is sexist, this is offensive, this is not a view that I feel comfortable with being heard, the ability to express that from the reverse, from the oppositional side, is what really matters, that those voices are being heard.
Okay, Kate, what's your views on either of those?
I completely disagree with you on the LSE rugby club.
With me?
With you, yes. I think it just demonstrates that you haven't been an undergrad for a very long time. Because I completely share your concern about shutting things down, and I agree, for example, about Exhibit B. But I want to compare two situations at the University of London. One is the LSE rugby club, which was shut down, which was suspended for a year after a series of violent threats, racist statements, sexist images, and then the banning at UCL of the Nietzsche Society, which was completely outrageous. UCL recently, posters that went up around UCL advertising a Nietzsche Society, which the student union decided was a gateway for fascism. And I mean, none of these were clearly philosophy undergraduates. And you know what? Probably there are a few undergraduates who like being provocative and like to experiment with fascism, aged about 19, and maybe they use the Nietzsche Society to do it. But universities are supposed to be places like the Institute of Ideas where you can explore all the ideas that are out there. if only to discover their flaws and their shortcomings and get them out of your system at 19, including fascism, if you can get it out of your system at 19.
And including being a kind of, you know, provocative...
Here is the difference. Here is the difference, because when we talk about abstract ideas, we can debate them. When we disseminate images, we are making effectively violent threats. And the reason I feel so strongly about this is I just remember such a parallel, and then I'll shut up and let the other people move, talk. When I was, and I agree that schools are crucial, and university is often where women who have been brought up to be very strong and very competitive and ambitious suddenly encounter the way that boys are going to treat them in the workplace. I certainly did, having been to a very pushy all-girls school and never having realised that there were going to be men who weren't used to... So I went to Oxford, got really quite ill in my first year, took a year out, had serious glandular fever and quite a collapse, and I came back a year later feeling incredibly nervous, and the first thing I saw was this massive poster over the front hallway with a woman wearing nothing but bondage tape, with her hands handcuffed, and a big bubble saying, "The only people who can make me come are the new college football team. Join the new college football team." And you know what? This was Oxford University. This was Oxford University. This is supposed to be... And, of course, it was ridiculous. And, no, I didn't complain, because partly because we weren't enabled as feminists 10 years ago. This was 10 years ago. There wasn't a culture of complaining or getting a woman's officer to do... You just sort of moved on. But I felt, on that first day back, this is a place where I'm supposed to feel uncomfortable.
Okay, interesting. Anne?
Well, you know, I was at university at the same time as Claire, because I think we're about the same age. And I think one of the things that I find very difficult about this discussion sometimes is that kind of... the fact that you don't understand us shows how long ago you were exposed to these things, because I don't actually think it was terribly different when we were at university. I remember during my freshers week, a leaflet being put out. So I don't know whether it was by the rugby club. I mean, I'm intrigued at the idea that the LSE rugby club has got anything to say about women. They would want to put out a leaflet. They might be better off putting out stuff about their gaming technique. I don't know. You know, it sort of doesn't work. But when I was in Freshers Week, some club or other had put out something with the title on it saying, "Feel a little fresher." And I don't think they were inciting the girls to touch up the boys who were coming into the college. And that kind of stuff just went on then. And it's just that I think that possibly it was... There was something about the way that we might have looked at it a little bit differently, because I don't even think anybody would have thought to have run a campaign against it, not because we were intimidated about it, but because in the scheme of things, I think that probably you sort of felt that any guy who came and tried to feel you up, you would possibly thump in the jaw rather than feel that you needed to run a campaign around it. And there were a whole load of other things that were going on as well. And possibly if I'd walked in to a college and I'd been confronted with a picture of a naked woman bound up with tape and a bubble coming out saying only the football, whatever football team can make me come, I think I would have felt as removed from it as possibly any of the guys walking into the college, because it would have looked so different to me, and I wouldn't have thought they ever had me in mind in the first place, because it really was such a removal thing. And I think what I'm saying is that I don't think that any of these things are insignificant problems, because I think that we internalise stuff, and sometimes things make us feel really shitty. You know, they really do. But to my mind, feeling really shitty is a bit of a kind of personal thing, and I don't think you can run the whole world on the basis of I want to get rid of anything that makes me feel bad about myself.
OK, I'm going out to the audience, but I'm going to keep coming back to the panel, because I want it to be a kind of conversation, and we've got some scope for that, and to just kind of weigh up those things, because I don't want you to overdo the hashtag bit of this title, because it wasn't, you know, it's not just about hashtags. But in a way, there is an interesting side of the hashtag question, which is the point that, Kate, actually you made, which is a tendency to say that if you don't retweet the right Caitlin Moran latest, you're in trouble. But also has been the rather dispiriting experience of so many of the closing down and the you know, the demands for the jailing of trolls, the reporting of abuse and so on, has come from feminists. And as you're disquieted by Nietzsche and you by Exhibit B, what I find difficult is we live in a censorious climate, and it seems to me that often feminist campaigns are at the forefront of the closing down bit. And so, you know, obviously the people who closed down Exhibit B were here. I don't mean the Barbican, because it wasn't them, the anti-racist protesters. They'd say within our terms that was legitimate. Of course they would. But it was wrong. So it's working that out, because there's also been good points made about some of the unpleasant things that women have to confront as well. OK, over to you. Right, now, I'm going to be... lots of hands, that's good. So the first person I'm seeing is there and then there. I've got you, and I will come back down to you. And then there's one person up there for front afterwards. Row. Yeah.
Front row.
Yeah. That low. Yeah, Ungar's low. Yeah, right.
Thanks. I just wanted to come back on something that Anne said in her opening remarks about women still hitting barriers to gender equality when they reach childbearing age. Mm. Because I'm sitting here as someone who works full-time and has got three children, and I wouldn't pretend for one second that that's easy. But I think some of the barriers that I experience are every bit the same as barriers who are experienced by men who also work full-time and have children. I think things have changed massively in the course of the past 10 years in relation to practical barriers that women might experience. So nursery provision, yeah, it's not free, and no, it's not cheap, but it is a lot more available and for a lot longer hours than it was even 10 years ago. Women now have the right, just as everybody with children, to request flexible working, and a year-long maternity leave has now become the norm for women. So I think a lot of the practical barriers that people face, in particularly where I work, and seems like in some other workplaces as well, employers are actually falling over themselves to almost show positive discrimination towards women when it comes to awarding pay rises and promotion. But this is not to say that I don't think women are experiencing any barriers, but perversely, I think the barriers that women experience today are barriers that have come about as a result of some of those victories. So if you take the year-long maternity leave, for example, as soon as that was a possibility, it almost became the norm that you would take a year-long maternity leave. So ironically, it's the campaigns and the success of those campaigns and the result of those campaigns now coming to fruition that acts as a barrier. So as soon as it is assumed that you will take a year, and the pressure, kind of moral pressure on you, then if you don't take a year's maternity leave, what's wrong with you? You're not a good mother. And then your boss kind of assume that you will take a year. You assume you will take a year. And obviously then, when you go back into the labour market after that year, it is more difficult to make the same progress in your career as you were before.
OK, thank you. So who's got the mic? Yeah, you up there. And then where was the next person? Oh, yeah, you, sir. A couple of people, then I'll come back to the panel, and then I'll come out again. And I'll start with you.
I was just at a session where a woman spoke, saying that she would be scared to go to football in case, and she's a teacher, in case they called her a slut and had derogatory ideas about women. And I suppose what my question is that what used to inspire me about the idea of women's liberation is that there would be women and men that you could look at that were trying to change the world and work together, like the idea of civil rights for black people. And it seems to me today that increasingly the discussion around feminism on the campus and elsewhere in society, whether it's about elevator eyes, and not even what you do, but how you look at people, what you say, is about separating one another, is about presenting women as victims as opposed to in control of their own destiny. and actually not working together to improve things. I still think old-fashioned ideas like 24-hour creche facilities, more freedom over control over women's bodies are still important things that we've got further to go with. But in an age where we're constantly isolated and separated from one another, should it not be more about the idea that women are as strong as men and can change the world and we can do it together, rather than opposing one another with ideas about what we can and can't say and what we shouldn't look at, how we shouldn't look at one another?
Okay, thank you very much. Yes.
Interestingly, I am the woman who got called a slut at football match. Thank you very much. I'm a sociology teacher and I haven't had to prepare lessons this week due to the news. So two stories, one freezing eggs, freeze your eggs in Google, yes. And the second one, that reported rapes are up 29%. So reported rapes, are women reporting rapes more because hashtag feminism has given them the voice to speak? Are they reporting rapes more because the Jimmy Savile and the other revelations have made them think again about things that have happened to them? Are they reporting rapes because of our kind policemen that are now taking women more seriously, or are there in fact 29% more rapes going on there?
Thank you very much. Very, very important. I don't know. I mean, the panel can say what they want, but hopefully that's going to also come up in the session this afternoon on victim-centred law, because it's going to be looking at some of that. So it might give it a bit more detail. But I just said I'd take a couple more and then the panel, but I can't remember where I've gone. Has anyone got a microphone, or am I just being hopeless? Right. Give it to someone who's nearby end of a row. Someone, anywhere. Put your hands up again. Oh, it's all gone horribly wrong. Right, so down here. You just sneaked in, and then I'll come back to you, Kate, and just pick up anything you want. And then Anne.
I just thought it would be important to clarify what feminism by definition is. It's the advocacy of women's rights on the grounds of equality of the sexes. I don't feel that anyone, not anyone, that would be a bit much to say, but I don't feel that enough people recognise that feminism is both for men and women, that we both need it. And young people, we grow up with these separate spheres and we're grown up in different ways. And I think we all need feminism to combine ourselves together and to make a more unified body, to make us grow in a completely different way. And that was basically
no, good. Thank you. Very useful contribution. Kate?
I just wanted to pick up on two things. The first, your question, to ask you what sector you work in that you found such great support.
Higher education,
yeah. Because I think that, you know, you're incredibly lucky. The experience across a lot of sectors is not what you have experienced. And to remind everybody that the issues that we were all discussing really in the 70s about the pay gap, you know, the pay gap is still there. And the pay gap is there because women and men work in traditionally very different industries, and women are in service, largely in low-paid part-time work, where their work is not valued, their contribution to society is not valued in the same way as the traditional male industries. And that still exists. So we may presume to have equality, but actually, how equal is that? I'm not convinced about that. And then I wanted to pick up on your point about not victims. Of course we're not victims, but the reason why young women, particularly at university, have grabbed hold on this and fight on these issues is because, to go back to my first point, that's what's affecting them personally at the time. They encounter sexism, they encounter the sort of thing that Kate has talked about with the rugby club, etc. They encounter that and feel outraged, quite rightly so. They have, a 17, 18, 19 year old has no concept, can't conceive of what battles there may be for her as a woman along the rest of the road. She may know it theoretically, intellectually, that it's going to be hard to marry a career with motherhood, but until you experience it personally, it's really, really hard. So all I would say is to be a little bit more generous, that actually that's their way of screaming their rage, and this isn't fair, this isn't right. And it's not that they're victims, it's just that they're not being victims by standing up and saying, I don't want to be talked to in this way, this doesn't feel right to me, this isn't fair.
Anne, pick up anything.
I think that they're there is a kind of confusing scene in the way that it appears these days, because I think it looks on the surface very much more as though there is so much attention given to the idea, well, given to supporting women and supporting girls. And I think there are big questions about what lies underneath it. I see it in my work where if you look at international development aid, for example, at the moment, everything is focused on the girl child. You know, you would really think, you know, there is nothing in terms of the world of international development all about the girl child. There's a lot of discussion in schools, in social services and so on about empowering girls, protecting girls, laws and so on that will defend girls and defend women. And it looks as though, on one level, as though things have really flattened out. I think that's also contributed to by the fact that a lot of men are having a lot worse time now than they used to in the past. I think, you know, we have seen the fact that the reason why unemployment and women's employment has flattened out, and on one level there appears to be less of a discriminatory scene, is because the poor paid part-time jobs that have traditionally been done by women have had the economic climate and restructuring has had less of an impact on those than it has on the traditional male jobs, which means that in some places, yes, you have seen situations where men appear to have been completely disadvantaged by being pushed out of the labour market, and women appear to be very much in the centre of that. Does that mean that things have changed in the way that you were saying in higher education? I just think that is utterly wrong, because I think that when you look at the examples that you raise with this, you can see what the issue is, because on the one hand, the rhetoric of the girl-woman empowerment gives the impression that when you are working in society and in the world of work, things are still all about you and the way that it's organised about you as a woman. And it kind of misses the point entirely that employer situations are not concerned with the rights of women. They're concerned about making their places run efficiently. So it's absolutely true, without a doubt, you now have the right to request flexibility, but there are very few employers who will give you the flexibility that you need out of your job, because at the end of the day, they have to get the job done.
Yeah.
You know, I work in what is probably the most woman-sympathetic employer in the entire nation, and when the receptionist comes to me, or not to me, comes to our HR department and says, I want a bit more flexibility in my job, you say, do you know what? The clinic has to open at 9 o'clock. Mm. You're stuffed. Mm. So that whole notion... Well, they don't say that. They're much nicer than I am. This is the reason why I'm not allowed to tweet. So, you know, because that... Or if it happens, I'm not allowed to anywhere near HR. So, but, you know, that's the sense of it. You've got a job that needs to be done regardless of the idiosyncrasies of the person in front of you. The whole maternity leave thing. Mm. You know, on the one hand, it's seen as being a great victory for women. Well, I tell you, one of the things, and I don't know what the answer is on this, but there you are. You know, we have got good maternity rights in this country. Let me tell you. So there you are, as an employer, you're interviewing two candidates. One is a 26-year-old woman, the other, or let's say a 30-year-old woman. One is a 30-year-old bloke. Both of them are absolutely equally talented. Both of them have got no children. You're talking to them about the thing, I don't know, you assume, let's assume that you assume that they're both heterosexual. Which one of those is more likely to be disruptive to your workforce going forward? And it's going to be the woman. And one of the reasons why it's going to be the woman is not only because she might be having the baby and taking a bit of time off, which you can more or less anticipate that she will probably do, but probably because she's now going to take a years-long maternity leave because the magazines and so on tell her that she's going to, and so on, which actually prejudices things against her even more. So my point being is that I think things have moved on in the sense that it's not the case that men are now seen as being empowered and women and women are not. It's now the situation that there are a whole load of people whose lives are completely stuffed by the way the society and the economy works at the moment, but women have still got some particular barriers that they've got that men don't actually confront. So, you know, we're still in a difficult situation. Call it oppression? I don't know anymore, but it's different.
OK, thanks.
What's just been said, but I think I'd come at it from the other angle, because after all, Anne, when you were talking right at the beginning, you talked about four pillars of feminism in the 70s, equal pay, contraception, abortion, childcare and education. And my response was, gosh, do we have to sign up to all of those to be a feminist? I mean, the conservative in me, for example, agrees that actually, if we're going to kickstart the economy, we need big business to be able to do what it needs to do to make some money. And that makes affordable childcare very, very difficult. That doesn't stop me from being a feminist. The reason why I think as you say, maternity leave is going to be one of the biggest issues, and it's entirely tied up with this problem that we have so far, which is the exclusion of men from feminism, which has been talked about earlier. It's one of the things that also worries me most about Twitter feminism. Are we having conversations online that are women talking to each other and reveling in talking only to each other? Is the hashtag sisterhood just a series of jokes about how men smell? But to extend that to the question of maternity leave, I think one of the biggest problems is that we have defined victories for feminism. We have used those victories to define a particular type of womanhood, a womanhood that actually indulges in the domestic. And by that I mean that if we obsess about maternity leave, then we buy into the idea again and again that a woman is the most important parent, that a woman's bond with her child surpasses a father's bond with his child. We cannot campaign for equality in the workplace if we deny equality in the home. I mean, if you take one thing away from me, it should be that. I think one of the most dangerous victories for feminism has been the increasing exclusion of men from custody of their children, which, again, perpetuates this idea that woman is the natural parent, the primary parent. I know of sort of several cases where the ex-wife has an impressive corporate job, and the father is still the one paying most of the child support and not seeing the children much, which is everything that we as feminists should believe in turned on its head. If we want to compete with men as workers, we have to allow them to compete with us as parents. I think that gets at where I wanted to sum up, which is this problem of a set of values that we all have to sign up to be good feminists. One of the books I've enjoyed most recently is Roseanne Gay's Bad Feminist, which is about the impossibility, of course, of ticking any of these boxes. I think we all have to acknowledge that none of us get it right. But if I leave you with one thing, it should be that. It should be...
We're not finishing yet. No, no, God, probably more. There's a lot of men's hands up. There's lots of men, though. I'm taking these two men, and then I'm going to go to the back. What I was going to say was, I do get nervous every time a man says I'm a feminist, mind you. it never fills me with great hope. Right, that gentleman there, then that gentleman there, and then you're right. There's people at the back that I'm not seeing. So wave your arm.
Yeah, back. Wave up there.
So that person at the back, okay, back. And then there's right down the front as well.
The premise of this talk here is that feminism is in danger, or has in part become censorious. The point I'm going to make is that it's fundamental to feminism that it's censorious. It's fundamentally oppressive, in fact. Anne Faraday commented that she thought that feminism in the 70s had become the anti-Marxism. It amazes me how almost everyone doesn't understand the history of identity politics, which is sometimes misconstrued as political correctness. It's nearly 100 years old. It's all about the political left backlash against the workers for not rising up. The workers stereotyped as male. So it's an attempt to solve the cognitive dissonance in the political left mindset, if you like. That's where feminism, third wave feminism, springs from. Why is people don't understand this? It's absolutely beyond me. The base of that is oppression. It's not about addressing any problems in reality. It's about a political expedient.
Okay, thank you. There's a gentleman. No. Move the other way. If you don't, him. Right. Yes.
Hi. There's been a lot of mention of what I would call feminist metrics, differences in pay gap, male-dominated industries. Now, there doesn't seem to be much talk of what underlies that, the choices that lead to these discrepancies. I'm a software developer, and there's historically very, very few women in my job. Mm. Now, neither me or the software female software developers I work with being able to get to the bottom of this. And so I'd like to see more feminists talking about the choices that women make, because I don't see any discrimination against women going into certain industries, male-dominated industries. I think female engineers are very welcomed. So why...
it's a very good question, because I don't know what the answer is. So has anyone got the mic at the back? Whoever's got it, stand up and speak. Sorry, can you come down to this person who I've ignored completely? Yes.
I share Anne's political experience as a young woman looking around and seeing, you know, amongst people who wanted to make the world a better place, that there were alternatives to feminism, that there was Marxism, which offered a kind of a more universal approach to, you know, social change. And I just wonder now how Anne or the rest of the panel can think that they, you know, that now Marxism is off the table, really, as an alternative. I mean, anti-capitalism is around, but it's just as therapeutic and identity-driven as feminism. You know, is there any kind of political approach that women can take that doesn't sound like special pleading? I mean, I agree with Anne, actually, that that women, particularly women of childbearing years, their careers suffer. You know, they face a lot of obstacles that men don't. And Hannah Rosin's book on the end of men, you know, makes the point that it's not just that men are suffering in the new post-industrial economy, but women are, you know, taking on this double burden. They are in the workforce and they're doing, you know, much more childcare at home and much more of the domestic work. So, is there any kind of politics? Do we campaign for equal pay, for free childcare, for reproductive rights, these kinds of things, without it sounding like special pleading? Is there any way that we can involve men and make it more of a universalist project?
Okay, thank you. Down here at the front. So we've got to somehow get the mic over to that section. Yeah.
Two things. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Right. Two things. You were at the beginning. We were talking about going to university and seeing this woman and so on. I remember when I went to university, there was this huge banner that said, "Well, welcome fathers, thank you for your daughters." And it was a huge banner, and of course my father was driving me to university. And, you know, what I thought was not, oh, this is a place where I'm being delivered into the hands of these animals. Was, wow, I'm an adult now, and I'm expected to, and it's okay now to experience risque ideas, and I'm expected to be able to deal with them. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. Like, I've really arrived. I'm in the adult world. Standing up is really hard when you're kind of nervous.
No.
Anyways, I'm just going to sit down. Because the second thing is that when the problem of censorship was mentioned, I saw you kind of roll your eyes and say, no, that's not really an issue. I really do think, maybe it's just in social media, but it is a really, really big issue. I think, recently I made this terrible social media mistake of liking an article that Brendan O'Neill had posted. And I was, you know, I was really, really attacked just for liking this article. And someone wrote to me in my sort of message, I was sort of going back and forth with this person, and he was saying, you know, it's a really good thing that we don't work together because I could get in trouble just for talking to you. Which was so bizarre. And the article was, you know, really attacking sort of trans women. But he made a good point, and he said, You know, I thought if gender is supposed to be a social construction, how can some people be born with a female brain and a predilection to wearing dresses? I thought that's what people were supposed to be fighting against. And I thought, well, that's a good point. And I mentioned that to this person in this Facebook exchange, and he said to me, how dare you criticize these people from your cisgendered privileged position? And I thought, well, Jesus, you know, I've been many things in my life, but I've never considered myself privileged, particularly because I was born a woman. So something really backward is going on, and there seems to be some sort of fetishization of difference.
Okay, thank you. The person next... Did you want to speak? The person next to you? No, no. Okay, so wherever we are...
There's lots of...
Yes, with the man with the mic, the man with the mic at the moment, and then get it up there. If we go up and get all those in, that'd be great. Thank you. Sorry, everyone. There's a couple on the way you can stop at. Yes, where are you? Yes.
For me, the thing to aim for in all this is for not just gender equality, but for gender to not define people. So when you see someone, you don't see them as a man or a woman, you see them as a person. And sometimes I see areas of feminism that I don't really believe are aiming for this. For example, Emma Watson's speech, I really loved a lot of what she said, but the very fact that her campaign is named He for She is of itself splitting people by their genders. It's saying men for women, not people for people, everyone for everyone, aiming for equality. It's aiming for men to help women more, which I agree would be moving more towards equality, but still it's splitting people. And the fact that feminism is called feminism, that's feminine, that's a woman thing. Like, if you had something called masculinism or something, it's not really focused on equality, in my opinion, although a lot of its ideals are. For example...
Finally, quickly, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. QI... the TV show QI aren't allowed to air an episode without a woman on it. And in my opinion, that's not actually going towards equality, because that means that they're putting people on that show purely because of their gender, not necessarily because they're funny or anything. I mean, I admit with perfect equality, there would be roughly a 50-50 split of men and women, but that doesn't mean you should put someone on just because they're a woman.
Sorry, I have to stop you there, just because you've made some very good points, particularly that point about, as it were, tokenism, ticking boxes. I'm sure that other people will want to come back on that. Who's got the mic now? Stand up, speak.
As a 15-year-old boy, I don't think I'm the best person to challenge this argument, but I'll give it a go. My understanding of feminism is a whole argument about liberty, is that you should be able to do what you want with your life, whether you're a man or a woman, and nothing should really hold you back from that. And what I'm hearing a lot of in this debate is basically there's not enough women equal to men in jobs and certain things. They get held back at certain points in their life. I come from home where my dad works full-time at a big corporate job. My mum works part-time in the legal firm in the city, so she can bring up me and my brother. And she's very proud of her job. And the fact that there's a lot of feminists saying that women need to have equal pay to men and women is kind of basically, it's not really honouring the choices that these women are making when they're going into part-time work and doing these jobs. I mean, I understand the need for equal pay, but sometimes I think that, is it really feminism for the good of society or just feminism for feminism's sake?
Thank you very much. That young lady just there, just pander the mic. Yeah, you take it and speak, and then whoever's got the mic can go next.
About the QI thing, I think it's all BBC panel shows. And I think it's funny when there's, one woman on the show because you can see it and it's kind of awkward. But I think... No, the thing that I love about this debate is this myth of misandry, that everywhere you go, because of feminism, men are suffering. And it's a lie. Because... Wait. You all take the stance of the same thing as affirmative action, or because these people are being oppressed, we have to do something. But all that's happening is we're talking about feminism. Women go through this thing and we're going to do something about it. But we don't. And then they are like, you say, oh, men are being oppressed in the workplace and things like that, but they're not. And what's happening is you're just getting angry about the fact that we're talking about feminism, but nothing has changed in the workplace. There is a war against single mothers everywhere. And this idea that feminism has to include men, it has tried. But the men make it about themselves. Every time you have a feminine discussion... Every time you have a discussion about feminism, it has to turn to, oh, but what about men? It's not fair, they're not included in this discussion. But you're changing the discussion, and it's not fair. We've still not dealt with the fact that there is no childcare. My mum said to me, she's a mother of three children, she's a single mother, and she works nights. She's been working nights for about 7 years, and she said to me, it's like you're being punished for having children. And this thing that you have to do, I have to become a career woman and I have to look after children at the same time. And this is feminism. And then someone will turn to me and say, oh, it's unfair because men don't get leave as well. They should. They should also be fathers. They should be, men should be allowed to take as much time as they need to be the fathers of their children, not just women.
Okay, thank you very much. At the risk of making myself particularly unpopular, I didn't set up this session to turn into a feminist rally. Organise it somewhere else. I do think, however, despite some very eloquent points that have been made, there are questions to be answered, which is that, for example, if everyday sexism says that describes a set of behaviour by any men that are so thinly veneered, you know, so much that somebody gives you a compliment, looks at you in the wrong way, are described as on a part of rape culture, that is not a very inviting way in for people to have some kind of campaign for equal rights. And the celebration of censorship, which is happening in some circles, at least has to be answered to. And I also want to ask a question, genuinely, whether women need to be protected. Because I wrote an article for the Times Education Supplement about the need for women, saying that women should be able to speak out, and I want to encourage young women to free speech and debating in terms of schools and so on. And therefore, I was concerned about the Lose the Lad Mags campaign, which was about closing down. Anyway, I was immediately castigated by a lot of young women who wrote various things, including the idea that, you know, we're in our sixth form, we go into Smith's, we see these lad mags, and it upsets us for the rest of the week. And I thought, what? I mean, this portrays women as kind of fragile. It's like a kind of Victorian, you know, I saw a rad mag and I couldn't, and if how will I be able to carry on? And I thought, grow up. Right, or get tough. I mean, the kind of... So I know that I'm doing this to be provocative, but I'm not just doing it to be provocative. How is it that aspects of feminism are not concentrating on some of the things you've said about fighting for equal rights and childcare and so on, all reasonable, but most of the kind of feminist activity that takes place is different.
Claire, I'm going to interrupt you.
No,
this,
good.
Because historically, I remember feminists being blamed for thinking only about burning bras. Do you remember that, people? You know, all feminists did was want to burn their bra. You know, yeah, not wear bras. You know, it's the same sort of thing. Or I remember women going into Smith's and sticking, this magazine discriminates women, sticking it slap bang on all those kind of lad magazines. This has happened forever. You know, it's a way of expressing your rage and your anger about the way women are treated or perceived or seen. And what happens is that it's now hashtag feminism because social media and Twitter is what we're all preoccupied with, addicted to, if you ask me. Okay, but it's the same thing as the fact that the media used to hang on to the fact that all women want to do is talk about burning their bras. That was what the media was obsessed with in the 1970s, not equal pay, maternity leave, or all of the things that we now know are what we need, families need.
Tempted though I am to row, I will carry on taking you. Right, okay, so quick. Get the mic. I can't cope with the microphone because I can't see it. Everybody, so you have to just hand it to people, kind of use your own discretion, vaguely. So give it to that lady there, and then there's a couple of people in the middle there. Who's got it now? You at the back, sir, then you.
Okay. So I just wanted to make a point how there seems to be a huge amount of uneasiness about censorship coming from this feminist perspective. But there's a lot of tension because on the one hand, yeah, you don't want to shut down discussion. But on the other hand, at some point, people have to be told, I've had to be told, you know, in sort of developing this better consciousness that you're wrong, that you can't say certain things, that certain things which you might have grown up thinking are okay to say are not okay to say. And somewhere in between, there's some point in between having your argument shut down and simply feeling that you should have this privilege to say anything you like, and you should just be allowed to say it, and no one can ever come along and just tell you, no, you can't say that.
Can you give us an example of something that you can't, that you shouldn't be allowed to say? This is the Institute of Ideas.
Yeah.
While he's thinking of what it is that he wanted to say, I think, though, that the issue about expressing your rage does become a really contested point because, for example, I actually don't have a problem with men looking at magazines that have got topless women in it. It doesn't make me angry at all. The endless amount of bake-off stuff that implies that I should be concentrating on making cakes does. So I don't think I'm going to get very far with sticking stickers on bake-off products.
Okay, very good. Yes, yes.
It's interesting that you say expressing rage because one thing that hasn't really come up today is the kind of language and the linguistics of feminism and the fact that, for instance, slut and cunt are obviously very kind of gender terms. And I just wanted to understand your perspective on the kind of reclamation movement and whether that's a force for good or indeed kind of a dangerous one.
Okay, thank you. There's a little grouping, so yes. Yes, and then you. Yeah.
Hello, is it all right if I don't stand up? Two things, really. One, anybody know of Anne Dixon, who wrote A Woman in Her Own Right? She's written a very interesting and quick read called Teaching Men to Be Feminists. And her opening remarks are about a definition of feminism, which is the best and easiest one I've ever heard of, which is feminism is a response to sexism. And I think that what the collectivism, our current ability to be able to campaign by the touch of a mouse, is really giving a lot of young women that I meet the opportunity to feel that they are not alone in the experiences that they have of everyday sexism. And the other, and I'll be quick, Claire, the other thing is that there is a very, very serious high end of this. And as you know, there's a campaign counting dead women, women who are killed by their partners, which some people see as the far end of the kind of prejudice and hatred that you can... We're not doing that. You've had your turn.
Yes.
In every way.
We've only got...
I'm going to pass it on. Where do you want me to go with this, Claire?
That's the lady behind you. Right, I can't take you all. It's impossible. That lady... Quick.
I just wanted to say, I think you're doing a disservice to something like the No More... Page 3 campaign, when you lump it in with censorship, because actually it's not saying it's not okay to look at women's breasts, although clearly it's not okay in other contexts and people aren't allowed to breastfeed in some places. It just, what the hell is it doing in a newspaper?
Exactly.
If it was a massive dip, that wouldn't be allowed.
And if I, can I come in on that?
No, you're all going to get a final sentence in a minute. We've got to have lunch. And that lady there has been so patient that she's got to come in. I've seen this gentleman, that gentleman, and that... Oh, it's a gentleman. Right, and then final lines from everyone. Yeah.
What you were saying about language of feminism sort of ties in with what I was going to say about what I perceive as a sort of circle of violence. I've just graduated from university, and recently I'm still on the sort of feminist, university feminist page, and they were talking about Emma Watson and how they didn't agree with her he for she campaign for various reasons, and I posted a comment just saying, oh, I'm not sure, you know, that we have to be so violent. She's trying to do something good. And there were discussions about whether I should be removed from this feminist group because I wasn't, you know, I don't know, towing the party line and, you know, that men and particularly university or uni lads shouldn't be included in the conversation. They need to recognise their own male privilege and sort of be humbled by it and all of these things. And I just think... But on the other side of that, I've first-hand experienced the vitriol and violence of the sort of the uni lad culture that you're talking about with the posters at Oxford, and that I think a lot of us experience at these, you know, with our my friends who I consider very intelligent 21-year-old males, and I just think it's this circle of violence. And I also just wanted to bring in
no, you can't.
Okay,
yeah, that lady there.
Just a couple of really quick points. I think the aim of feminism in the 70s was completely unclear. I think the aim of feminism now is completely unclear. What I'm interested in is the discussion about censorship, about relationships in the workplace, about employment. I think the relationships between men and women in the workplace is not just about different sectors and employment rights. The lady down there talked about experience within higher education. I work within big construction companies, big corporate companies. I would not like to be an older man in some of those companies at the moment. And Anne, I think in response to your scenario where the two 30-year-olds are being interviewed the job, the woman's going to get the job because she's going to work from home with a one-month-old baby in the cot. She's going to run the HR department, and it's the guys in some of those companies who are going to feel the consequences of what's happening at the moment.
Oh, that was very interesting. Thank you very much. That gentleman there.
Yeah, just shifting it kind of to the side for 1 minute. And I hate points that talk about as a type of person, but I'll just say this just to put some perspective on this. I'm sporty. I've always come from a sporting background. I'm also gay and I'm also male and I'm also anti-feminist. At the moment, I'm in part of a lesbian and gay swimming club. And recently we've had a debate about whether we should have a separate women's session. Women felt they weren't included, that they were excluded, that it was a male-dominated club, with a female chair, a female vice chair, a female swimmers rep, and a female treasurer. So we come into this parody, what I see as a parody. It's like it's a mantra that's listed out, and it's at the side of this general debate, but it makes it very important. People were scared to speak out. People were actually burying their heads because they did not want to confront the position that actually what these particular women wanted was their own session. That was the point of it, not whether they were oppressed, not whether they're people in the lane, whether they're equally sportive. It was nothing to do with that. And that's when it becomes a parody. And I think we need to look at how far the whole feminist movement has gone in terms of this parody.
Okay, so it's that gentleman there, then you, and then we're... Final sentence from the panel.
You'll have to excuse my speech. I've got Tourette's and I was the victim of a bastard state education. Anne Faraday, brilliant speaker. I'm really annoyed that everyone here seems to be confusing gender with sex. Gender is a social construct and you can get feminine men and masculine women. And like Anne Faraday, I come from a political background where feminism was seen as a structural thing. And, you know, women were done against structurally through the curses of capitalism and such. And I personally agree with affirmative action, because when you look at the CEOs of the FTSE 100 and high court judges, 2%.
Thank you very much. I'm really sorry to cut this off. So I'm finishing with the two young women there. I feel like saying throw the microphone, but that obviously won't work because we'll have injuries. Get ready and on standby to give us your final thought. Bear in mind there's lots of discussions on this over the weekend. Carry on.
This is just a response or a comment on what the software developer somewhere around here said. And I was just wondering whether you thought that a lack of representation in certain professions contributed to the lack of aspiration and ambition and how significant that was in the workforce.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I just wanted to say about the thing about the poster, and basically saying women shouldn't make a complaint about a poster which is supposed to be funny. I was just going to say, although you're basically saying to shut up, you shouldn't complain about it. What about like the 1 in 3 women who get domestically abused? Like that culture has to come from somewhere. And if we aren't going to get rid of these posters, then like what are we going to do to kind of make an awareness about it?
My view is they're not connected. My domestic abuse and the poster. One thing is very clear: is what would I do about the poster? I'd tear it down. That's generally my view. Kate, you okay? This Kate, in the audience spoke. Final thought.
Men, if you feel you're being excluded from the conversation, just get involved. You're fantastic. And in case I wasn't clear before, paternity leave is absolutely something that we need to push more for. Men, if you're not taking your paternity leave, you're part of the problem. Software engineer, do you really not think that if I go to a recruitment event for software engineers and there are 20 blokes there, and I go to a recruitment event for working in the theatre and there are 20 women there, I'm going to feel at some level more like I belong in the theatre group? That's what feminism really is all about. I agree with you, and I am going to sum up on this, I promise. I agree that feminism and I say this as a classical liberal, feminism should be about not being defined by your gender, not being defined by your class, going out there, not being a victim, and yes, that is crucial, not being a victim and just getting on with it. But as long as there are still structural problems that encourage us to look at the scientist and think that only little boys can grow up to be that person, and look at the cook and think that only a woman can grow up to be that person, that radical freedom still does not exist, at least in our own souls.
Thank you very much. Anne.
Well, somebody asked the question about what we can do that isn't whiny, you know, and I think for me it's still very straightforward. It's about posing the question to ourselves and people around us about what do we need for our liberation, and what do we need for our liberation from poverty and drudgery, not just in a material sense, but in an intellectual sense. And I think that the things that we need for our liberation from poverty and drudgery in both of those senses are exactly those things that we talked about before. They're about the pay and job opportunities, they're about the education, and here's where it comes down to something that you can do. Is there something about the reproductive choices, the freedom of control to make decisions about your own bodies, which is something that women have not got and don't get. And it's also about how you can raise children and combine it with the other things that you need in your life. Because one of the things that's so distressing, I think, about the organisation of childcare today is that even the organisation of childcare today is not what we wanted it to be. The organisation of childcare today is all about child development rather than about assisting all of us to be able to fulfil our intellectual, social and all of our development. So let's look at those things that really do stand outside of ourselves, rather than perhaps getting quite so caught up in what do I want to see, what do I want to hear, and look at how we can shape the world. Because frankly, if you do get offended by stuff, you can just be like me and not have your Twitter account.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Well, I'd just like to say that the sort of range of points that you've all made show just how vital and alive and necessary feminism still is. Because even though, you know, the sort of accepted view is that we've made it, women have made it, we have equality, you can do what you want, be who you want to be, the reality is very, very different. And I'd like to see society bringing out the best in all of us, irrespective of our gender. And for that to happen, to go back to the gentleman right in the back row who talks about why it's called feminism, I want to see more men talking feminism, and I don't see a lot of men talking feminism at the moment, which is why women, whenever they stand out, get the flack. They get accused of being censorious, as you would say, or just a little bit too angry, because that's not what girls should do, and that's got to change, that culture. And then as to what the political point, the one political thing is, in order to do that, I think we have to start putting the whole of the family centre stage in terms of everything to do with work-life balance, to do with the kind of the economy of our entire society, really. It's families' needs and how parents can meet those needs as well as work and contribute everything they have to offer.
Thank you very much.